just to ask some real nerd. We were talking about a typical sort of nighttime operation, and you were going through the sort of procedure and how you check the rear gun turret.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about this vane engine that drove the ammunition belt. So
yeah.
Carry on.
Vane oil motor.
So what else would you check?
That the guns were moving freely. That was just the turret rotated comfortably. And that the clear vision panel had been taken out.
What was a clear vision panel?
Clear vision panel was a panel in front, imagine a turret, right? Guns. Between the guns, two guns there, four guns. Between these, there was a sliding perspex panel. Now, perspex is not as clear as glass, but obviously you couldn't have glass. So the perspex panel slid up and down, and most gunners took it out because you got better clear vision with nothing in front of you except 20,000 feet of space.
So you did that as well?
Tended to make the turret very drafty, as you can imagine. So it was out. It was kept in the flight office, and sometimes the armourers would put it back in because the rain would blow into the turret or if it was snowing. See? So get it out, back to the flight office.
Anything else? Checking the aircraft? Or your turret you're talking about?
Well, you have a glance at the ammunition was in cans, I think I told you.
You did?
And just check that things are okay.
Now, when would you get your briefing? This is the check in the aircraft. That was before your briefing, was it?
Oh, yes. You did that every morning, even though you weren't operating, you went down to the flights.
What would you do next then? Well, a typical night operation day.
Well, you would have done that in the morning. If there was anything that you weren't sure about or didn't check, you know, were unhappy about, you told the NCO in charge, the chiefy. But I never ever had to report anything wrong because they were most meticulous in making sure that everything they could do to help you was done. They were very, very loyal, conscientious people. We took one of them actually on a trip one night, illegally.
I'll come back. So, what next then? You check your aircraft, what next? Yeah. In a typical day.
Then off you went. Generally, you hung about in the sergeant's mess or played snooker or something to pass the time until briefing.
Now, what was the briefing? Explain all about that.
The briefing was notified to you by the gunnery leader or the navigator, depending on your... That was one of the functions of the leadership of the various flight branches. But it's just a telephone call from the sergeant's mess, when's briefing. And they didn't broadcast it, because of course it was a security business. So you got to know when the briefing was, and you... sometimes you did things like exchanging your flying boots or, you know, any sort of odd thing that you wanted to do, then was the time to do it. Sort of making your will up to date if you'd bought a car or...
So what about the briefing?
The briefing, you come in, and the briefing room was laid out to be secure, of course. There were curtains over the target, and there was a policeman at the door, and he scrutinized everybody who went in, of course, to see that the name was useful. And in the briefing room, there were rows of chairs with an aircraft letter at the end of each row of seven chairs. Seven chairs, seven chairs, seven chairs, passageway, seven chairs, seven chairs, seven chairs. To make a complete one squadron, two squadrons, however many. And in the front, curtained target. At the door, a policeman, SP. And I remember this SP thought he would get in one night.
Special branch?
No, no. MP.
Military police.
RAF police. Sorry, not military. Sorry. RAF police. And I remember in one night.
Hang on, we'll come back. Keep to the.
Right, so right.
You're sat in your rows.
You're sat in your rows. And on the end chair, you all sat, the pilot at the outside, and you know, pilot, navigator, bomber, right, seven chairs. Each one a letter. Our aircraft letter was dog, bleak two, small two. And a bag, canvas bag, with the letter dog two. Hung on there, and inside it, seven little bags, also named, you know, rear gunner, mid upper gunner, navigator, bomb aimer, pilot, the whole crew number. And he, the pilot sat at that side, he dished out all the bags, and you put your wallet and your whatever you had in your pockets into this little bag. They were passed back to him, and he put them into the big bag. And tied the string on top, right? Nothing in your pockets. And you sat there, and the Met officer went up, and he gave the weather expected on the route, and also unveiled the target. And then he gave us briefing on the weather fronts and the weather we expected. The freezing level was very important. Freezing level was very important. This had been established by a weather Spitfire going hell for leather out over the continent, stripped to everything for speed, high level, taking photographs and coming back, taking the temperature and so on. So you got that up to date. The target, of course, and what the target was. Now, it could be marshalling yards, it could be docks, it could be submarine pens, it could be, you name it. The criticism since then was about bombing the cities. Well, if you're bombing marshalling yards are in a city. If you're bombing communications from armaments factories, they are railways and railway stations. Where are railway stations? Usually in the centre of a town. It's just inevitable that you're going to hit towns. There's no way out of it. It's either that or you leave the communications intact and the soldiers suffer at the front. So that's, as far as we were concerned, was sufficient reason for bombing what we did.
So you get the target. Anything else about the target?
Well, the reason for it, of course, obviously, the target Stuttgart or something like that. What are we bombing? We're bombing a munitions factory or a railway yard or marshalling yards. So you got that. And canals, the Dortmund Ems Canal was one I remember. And the reason was because the barges on the canal were taking supplies to defend, for the Germans defending the channel ports, Calais, Dieppe, and so on. So we bombed the Dortmund Ems Canal, burst the banks, the barges were all grounded, and stopped the supply of munitions and so on to the German front. So that was the purpose. We were usually given a reason for this, and we were also given a tactical brief summary of the situation regarding, particularly when we were cooperating with the army. Now, we did a lot of low-level cooperation with the army, which is not much publicized. And this low level was at 2,000 feet, sometimes lower, and the idea was to get rid of the tanks, because the German panzers were superior to the British and American Shermans, and when they got into a position in some of the scrub in Normandy, that's it, they got in there and couldn't be moved out, because, and the way they moved them out was they sent the Lancasters in and they blasted the tanks out of the path of the Americans. The Americans tried it from 40,000 feet and killed 500 Canadians, and that caused a tremendous, I mean, how the hell you could bomb from that height and be accurate enough, I don't know.
So, don't want to just get too bogged down, but so you get your target. Would you get a photograph of your target?
Yeah. We got a photograph of the target after it was bombed.
No, but did you, at the briefing, would you get given a photograph of the target?
Yes, I think we did. I'm nearly sure we did. But they had also target maps. I've got one, I'll show you. You see a target map, which it's difficult to describe, but it's an enlarged with areas blacked in where the factory is or whatever. So we would have seen a target map. Not perhaps a photograph, I can't recollect that, but perhaps a photograph.
And so anything else at the briefing?
We usually got a sort of political, brief political update of the state of the war, you know, where the front was. And this was, to some extent, so that if you were anywhere near the front line, this was after the invasion, or if it was a French target, for example, that you knew which direction to head in to for safety. General things. It was nothing that I can remember particularly.
So after the briefing, what would happen then?
After the briefing, you all sort of went out and had a smoke and whatnot. It was, you were given the time of takeoff, and then the various flight commanders would take this to the maintenance staff, the flights, and of course we, knowing it, would prepare ourselves, flying kit and so on, and just go and relax until the operational meal. And the operational meal was an hour before takeoff, so you knew when to go for your operational meal. What you did in between, you please yourself.
Now, what was the operational meal?
Ham and eggs. Always ham and eggs.
What? Why was that?
Because it was considered to be a sustaining meal. And I suppose it was sustaining as any. And when you came back, you got the same thing again.
And what did you do in that last hour, or what was left of the hour? You know, sort of 40 minutes after you had your meal.
Just loafed about, I suppose.
Now, what would you wear? From top to bottom, what would you wear, and what gloves and everything else?
Well, you started with a helmet and an oxygen mask, which was clamped on your face, and sometimes froze to your face, which is a nuisance. So what you usually did, somebody had a tin of Vaseline, and you smeared the Vaseline on your cheeks. And the oxygen mask was going to be there for about 5 or 6 hours. So it left grooves in your face. But if you didn't do that, your breath froze and it stuck to your face And when you tried to get it off, it took the skin. So it was wise to put some Vaseline around your face. The oxygen shoe came down. It was a rubber crinkled thing. And invariably your breath froze up in it. So if you felt it was getting a bit, you short of oxygen, you crumpled it and the ice cracked away inside it. It was connected to an oxygen tube which came up into the, it came up through your legs, I think I remember, as well as the ammunition, and plugged into your oxygen mask. It had a clip which you clipped to your jacket. Now then, if you wanted to move in the aircraft, you had to have a portable oxygen bottle. Now the portable oxygen bottle wasn't in the turret. It was outside the turret, in the fuselage. So if there was an Elson in the aircraft, and you endeavoured to not to visit it, but in emergency you could go there, but I always made sure that my bladder was empty.
I'll come back to that, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, to get to this, you had, or anywhere in the aircraft, you had to unplug one, pull yourself out of the turret, into the tunnel, get this buckle out of its clips, turn it on, and plug it onto your tube. Having got that, you've clipped it onto your jacket, whatever it is, you're then mobile with an oxygen tube. It was a bit of a palaver, particularly if you had the amount of clothing it you needed on. And big fur boots and whatnot. It wasn't so bad getting in, it was getting out of the bloody thing, it was a trouble. Right.
So that's it, oxygen mask and helmet. What else? What were you wearing?
Right. Let's see. Well, we were issued with a silk vest and a white sweater, silk long johns, and heavy socks. I've got them still there, the heavy socks. And on top of that, the silk stuff, you had an electric flying suit, which was wired just like a...
Is that the Sidcot suit?
No. Sidcot was a canvas, waterproof thing. No, it was fawn coloured, and it was just wires all through it, just like a heated bed or whatever.
How well did it work?
Quite well, actually. Quite well. You put that on, but then you put your other... You had a big white sweater. You put that on top of it. You had what they called a calf cap comforter, which was a woolly that you folded. It was like a hollow scarf, and you folded one and put it on your head and put your helmet on top of that. Sometimes it was difficult to get it on because it was a bit bulky, so we didn't bother with them some. Anyway, that's that, the electric suit. On top of that, you had another flying suit, outer flying suit, and the plug for the electric flying suit came through a slot or a pocket or a slot, something, and plugged into the turret. I'm trying to think what. Oh, yes, you had, of course, a big furry boot, the lamb's wool lined boots, and thick stockings. That's about all we had.
What about any hands?
Hands, oh, yes, of course, you had chamois gloves, woolen fingerless gloves, and leather gauntlets.
And silk ones?
Yes.
Silk
fur? Yeah, about. Yeah. Because the heating suit came down to there. They didn't have.
To the cuff, yeah.
Yes.
So what would you have on first? You'd have silk ones first, or?
Yeah. You put on the gloves. No, chamois.
You had chamois. Didn't have silk ones.
Yes, you put them on top. It was chamois because it gave you a better grip. You see, if you wanted to do anything, you took off your gloves, but you left to the chamois, so your hand didn't freeze to the. See?
So it's chamois, then silk.
Yes.
And then on top?
And top, leather gauntlets. Some people had different gloves, you know, you could put in what you liked. But you had to be able to, gauntlets buttoned, press buttons. You had to be able to take them off if you wanted to do anything. And you had to have something left in your hands, otherwise it would freeze to the metal, take the skin off.
So that's what you'd be wearing, you'd get into this gear, I presume, that last hour, and then, what had happened next? What was the procedure? How were you taken out to the aircraft?
Well,
or is that the next stage? What would happen?
See,
you've had your last meal, not last meal. Yeah. You've had your operational ham and eggs.
Yeah. I'm just trying to think. There'll be a three-tonner or something outside. You didn't get. There were no crew buses. No squadron, it was just three tonner or five tonner. Even a Queen Mary. You know the Queen Mary? Long, low loader for carrying aircraft parts, wings and things. Anything that moved was used. Usually driven by a WAF. But it was invariably a three tonner. So you climbed into the back of that, carrying your chute and harness and whatnot.
Well, tell me about the parachute. We haven't mentioned the parachute and harness. Tell me about that.
Well, on the way to the. After the briefing, you went down to the flying clothing parachute section, equipment section, really, I suppose it was. And usually, you see, it depended on. One of us went to the parachute and collected all the parachutes, and somebody else went and did something else. Sometimes the pilot went and got a flask of coffee, but we didn't bother with that. It had been too much, too difficult carrying it about. But in the front, it was convenient to have a drink of something hot. We got into the three-tonner and called at the parachute section. It would take two crews, probably, in the three-tonner. Usually with aircraft close together in the dispersals. And call at the parachute section. One of each crew would jump out and go and get the chutes and chuck them, and we'd pick them up and take them. They're all named with a rear gunner, so on, mid upper and all this. And climb back in and set off for the dispersal. Go to dispersal, unload, and climb into the aircraft. And set about sort of making yourself comfortable in your little domain. And then there would be a start-off time. Usually there was a time given when you all pressed the start button. Sometimes it was done by a Vary cartridge. If some of the dispersals were out of sight or that, they would fire a Vary cartridge as well.
So what was the takeoff procedure from, you know, from when you got to your aircraft?
Well, you all went in, took in your chutes and bits. The bomb doors were usually left open when the aircraft was on the ground. And you went and had a look underneath to see what you were carrying. That's when I got the leaflets out of the bomb carriers that I have. Because we sometimes carried propaganda leaflets and bombs. So there's a rude answer to that. Give them the shits and give them the paper to wipe it up. Rude comments. Then we climbed in and sort of settled in and checked out what we could. And the mechanics were outside, giving the wind up, you know, start the starboard inner usually fast, because the starboard inner worked the electrics of the other parts, the radio and so on. And then he did that, and the old thing started up and got them all going, ticking over, and started moving out of the dispersal. The lad usually took you out, you know, and once he got you on the taxiway, off you went. Taxied round, and you'd see a whole stream of them all leaving the dispersal, one after the other. So there it was. Out you went, and the caravan, they didn't use the radio for that, because it, of course, it could be monitored, I suppose. The caravan gave you a green, the runway caravan, which was a chap at the end of the runway, flashed you a green, and there was usually a crowd of WAF and people all along there waving and blowing kisses. The girls would be there, there'd be a big crowd of them there. And what we used to do is, I used to turn the turret to them and put the guns down. You'd be careful not to press the trigger. One bloke did that. And luckily the guns were up. And there was a big hoosh about that. And all the gunnery leaders were told, you better tell it, you do not fire bullets. But you kept the guns pointed at the ground, not at this chap was doing that, and luckily they were up and didn't kill anybody.
Now, how are you feeling in yourself, your morale, as they say? I mean, would you be nervous at any time? When would you be most nervous, or were you quite calm most of the time?
I think it was the fact that everybody else was doing it. You know, I don't know how other people reacted, but I wasn't terribly concerned about it. Maybe I was too stupid to think about it. You did occasionally have a... I'll tell you what was the worst thing, was watching others go down. You know, I remember when we were flying, coming back, and there was another Lancaster, it must have been about a mile behind us, and all of a sudden, we were, phew, like that. 1 minute they're there, the next minute they're gone. And the other thing was seeing your track. I remember seeing, coming away from the target, now they all came out in the same heading for home, you know, and seeing four flamers on the ground behind us. Now the night fighter pilots, which shot them down, I suppose, they knew where the tack was, so all they had to do was fly along it.
We'll come on to that more, but I see what you mean. So when you'd taken off, what did you have to do? As a rear gunner, what was your job as you were flying? Say you were going to Frankfurt. Yeah. What would you do?
Continually search. Not so intensively until you got to sort of near the channel or over the channel, but once you got down over the south coast of England, You were looking everywhere.
And how did you do it? Did you do it logically, from, you know, or did you, which way? How did?
Well, it sometimes depended on where the other Lancasters were, because